It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. All this week, we've been checking in on the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. We've had fiery speeches from members of the Republican Party, many calling for party unity, others in support of Donald Trump or against Hillary Clinton. Some members of the GOP, such as Senator Ted Cruz, not really on board with Donald Trump. And the biggest news of all, not really a big surprise at this point, Donald Trump is really the Republican nominee for president. We want to hear from you. What was your biggest takeaway from this week's convention? What do you want to see from the Democrats next week? Should Ted Cruz have endorsed Donald Trump? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. Joining us now for a look back at the RNC and the road ahead is Lily Gorin. She's a professor of political science at Carroll University. Lily, always good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me on today.
Well, big picture, looking back at this week of Republican conventioneering, do you think they did what they were hoping to do when it comes to party unity, united message coming out of it?
I'm not sure it was the most united RNC convention. I'll put it that way. Mm-hmm. I think that there were definitely calls and moves towards unity, and there was a lot of the, you know, sort of speeches and conventioneering that you expect from all of the, you know, political conventions in the last 20 or 30 years have been more, you know, generally infomercial and pep rally than they are, you know, actually delegates voting different ways and having sort of broad discussions about the candidates. That sort of went out with the advent of caucuses and primaries. But, you know, given the fact that most of the time these are four-day kind of infomercials for the candidate and for the party, there were probably some missteps and some, say, shall we say, unforced errors that transpired in the course of the week that made it a little bit less of the traditional pep rally infomercial.
I want to look at Donald Trump's speech last night a little bit. The message, of course, his party's not in power. There's going to be a critical message about the state of the country and the party that is in power. This was a little darker, a lot of people have been saying. This was sort of America is Gotham City before Batman shows up, almost. Like, really highlighting the idea that we're not safe, we're not secure, only Donald Trump can fix those problems. What did you make of that tone?
I think it's a little bit different than the tone that you usually expect from the person who's receiving the nomination from the party to be their presidential standard bearer. And if you look back at speeches by, you know, George W. Bush receiving the nomination in 2000 and again in 2004, at Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012, if you look back at even at Bob Dole, if you look back at Bill Clinton, you do see a sort of consistent, you know, usually a message of hope and, you know, sort of a positive moving forward. You do have, you know, sort of an attack on the party in power, the president in power. But a lot of the speech by the presidential nominee is usually about, you know, bringing the party and voters together behind that individual. Trump was consistent in his theme, but it was not one that necessarily inspired hope.
Let's give a listen to Trump. Another issue he's been talking about in addition to safety and security, jobs, trade, the economy. Here's a listen.
Every day I wake up determined to deliver a better life for the people all across this nation that have been ignored, neglected, and abandoned. I have visited the laid-off factory workers and the communities crushed by our horrible and unfair trade deals. These are the forgotten men and women of our country, and they are forgotten, but they're not going to be forgotten long. These are people who work hard, but no longer have a voice. I am your voice.
And that's kind of the ultimate populist appeal, I guess, Lily. I am speaking for the downtrodden, the forgotten people who have been overlooked by the elites of the country.
And that was a lot of what his message was last night, was he is the only person, the way he described it, who is giving voice to people who are downtrodden, who have lost their jobs, and so forth. And so that was the message he was communicating. But he also didn't, to some degree, I guess, in my analysis, turn the corner and talk about how he was going to move forward in what he was going to do with that voice.
He really seems to be staking his campaign on people agreeing that the country is in bad shape when it comes to crime, terrorism, and the economy. The economy, there's been a gradual, not awesome, recovery from the recession. Some people are pointing toward crime stats, relatively low when you look at a four-decade span. Can he make that case? Do you think people are going to listen to what he's saying and the headlines that are out there and say he's right, things are bad?
I mean, I think we certainly see this a lot when we have, you know, shootings, and we have shootings not only in this country, but there was, you know, a recent headline in this situation that's going on right now in Munich in Germany, that we have, you know, these issues of terrorism that are frightening, that we've also had in the United States some, you know, level of anxiety and fear higher than it had been before 9/11. But at the same time, you are right to cite the fact that there are, you know, there's been a 40-year decline with regard to violent crime, particularly homicide, across the United States. And so there is a disconnect, perhaps, between some of the articulation of, you know, the cities are burning, and what it is that most of us experience when we walk down the street in an urban area.
We're looking at the Republican National Convention with Lily Gorin from Carroll University, and you can join in 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. We'll go to our callers now. We've got John on the line in Duluth, Minnesota. John, hi.
Hi. Donald Trump is a demagogue. It's been from day one. The author of his book, his biography, just gave an expose on the radio in the last couple of days. How false it was, how empty he was. His college or whatever it was is ripping off students all through the years. He never cared about that. And we've had a history of demagoguery through the country. It appeals to the same classes through history, and he's only the latest person. And he's a dangerous person because nobody can control
John,
how he
thanks.
Will act.
I want to bring our guest in on this, Lee. John, placing Donald Trump, he says, in the history of demagoguery in the United States. How do you see that that history playing out? Obviously, the Republicans at this convention didn't agree with that.
No, I mean, Donald Trump was nominated by the Republican voters, and you know, people throughout the primary season, there were concerns from Republicans who were not supportive of Trump and continue to be concerns. I mean, Ted Cruz's speech, even at the convention, sort of articulated some of those concerns. But there is, you know, there is a sort of perpetual concern in our system, in a democracy, with regard to the you know, problem of demagoguery, which tends to prey on individuals' fears and sort of negative emotions.
You mentioned that speech by Senator Ted Cruz a couple days ago. Let's give a listen to one of the more dramatic moments.
You love our country and love your children as much as I know that you do. Stand and speak and vote your conscience. Vote for candidates up and down the ticket who you trust to defend our freedom and to be faithful to the Constitution.
Not clear from that speech if that candidate would be Donald Trump. I want to bring in a caller on this now. We've got Tracy on the line in Phoenix, Arizona. Tracy, hi.
Hey, I just wanted to say that I just think that Ted Cruz is just pretty much, for whatever I liked him before, I just don't care for him anymore. I just don't see him as a viable candidate in the future.
Because of that non-endorsement there?
Yes. Yeah, I think you need to rally behind the party. He was invited to the party, you know, and he's not the nominee, and he wants his bat, and he wants his ball. He's the guy that lost, and he just wants to do whatever he can to try to, you know, I think he just feels sorry for himself.
Tracy, thanks a lot for that call. Tracy is not alone in thinking that, Lily. There's been, including former Governor Tommy Thompson, thinks, what did he say, something like the biggest act of political suicide he's ever seen. Is that true, or will we have Ted Cruz to kick around again someday?
I don't think Ted Cruz is leaving the political stage. I could be wrong, but I find it unlikely that he's going to sort of leave the stage. But there are two schools of thought on Ted Cruz's move on Wednesday night. One is, as Tracy noted, that he shouldn't have been saying that at the convention. He came to the convention. It's Donald Trump's convention. He should either endorsed or not said something as potentially unfavorable as he did, or he should have just not come. And there are a lot of people who did come. The Bushes were not there, and Jeb Bush was decidedly not there. There were a lot of other candidates who had run who weren't there. There were others like Scott Walker and so forth, and Chris Christie who had run and who were there and who gave speeches. But I think Ted Cruz's decision cuts two ways for people who support Ted Cruz and wanted him to be the candidate. A lot of people see this as Ted Cruz's sort of first move for the 2020 nomination. Other folks like the caller and others like former Governor Tommy Thompson suggest that, this is the end of Ted Cruz's political career. I don't know if it's the end of his career, but I do think it definitely divided people in terms of whether they will support him in the future or not.
We're talking to Lily Gorin, political science professor at Carroll University, talking about the Republican National Convention. We want to hear from you. What did you think about this week's convention in Cleveland? What were your takeaways? Were you inspired if you're a Republican? If you had doubts about Donald Trump as your standard bearer, you still have those doubts, or are you on board now? If you're watching from the outside as a Democrat or independent, what did you think? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. More coming up, and maybe we'll hear from you here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the Republican National Convention in Cleveland this week. We want to hear from you. What did you think about what you saw there? Were you impressed with any of the speakers? Maybe some of the non-main profile speakers? Should Ted Cruz have endorsed Donald Trump? What did you think of Donald Trump's acceptance speech last night? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Lily Gorin stays with us, professor of political science at Carroll University. Before we get back to our callers, Lily, I want to listen to Donald Trump responding a little bit to that Ted Cruz speech. This was this morning at a news event.
I like Ted. He's fine. Again, I don't want his endorsement. If he gives it, I will not accept it, just so you understand. If he gives it, I will not accept it. It won't matter. Honestly, he should have done it because nobody cares. And he would have been in better shape for 4 years from now if he's going to be. I don't see him winning anyway, frankly. But if he did, it's fine. Although maybe I'll set up a super PAC if he decides to run.
So a lot of people in the Republican establishment have been saying, don't worry, Donald Trump is going to start acting more presidential as he pivots into the general election. But people are saying, well, look at how he responds to criticism in that Donald Trumpian way. Are we going to see Donald Trump change that much, do you think, Lily, between now and November?
I don't really think that we've seen Donald Trump change that much over the course of the election. And so I'm not necessarily inclined to see that, to say that he's going to change that much in terms of, sort of being more consistent across the board. And you played one clip from this morning's press conference, but then he went on to relitigate a lot of the disputes that he and Cruz had over the course of the primaries, including this crazy idea that Ted Cruz's dad was involved with JFK's assassination. And he went on and on. And so the good press that he was getting out of the convention last night, he stomped all over it with regard to the press conference this morning, talking about these kind of strange ideas about Ted Cruz. Why is he spending time on this when he's the nominee?
Let's go back to our callers now. Anita is on the line in Lake Villa, Illinois. Anita, hi.
Hi. I just wonder if people want to do themselves a service of looking at some of the documentaries and posing them over the Trump speeches, when he's speaking, the first thing that goes through my mind are the ranting, crazy, only I can fix you speeches that were of the German dictator at the beginning of World War One, or World War Two, rather. And it's like it's the same thing. All they did was just change some of the verbiage, but his presentation and his ranting, it points to dictatorship.
Anita, thanks for the call. And there have been people on Twitter comparing Donald Trump's speech last night, not necessarily to Hitler, but to, I guess, more authoritarian leaders through history. People questioning why he keeps coming back to the phrase America first, given that it had ties with anti-Semitism between the two world wars. Is this something that you think is going to put voters off of Donald Trump, Lily?
I don't know if it's going to put them off of him in general, but I do think that, you know, the speech last night, as I said, as somebody watching it as a voter, I wasn't necessarily moved in a hopeful direction. And so in that regard, it was a speech that, you know, doesn't give me a picture of the United States as a wonderful, amazing place that many of us think that it is, but is this really sort of scary place. And Trump's making the argument that he's going to change it. But at the same time, there's, you know, the sort of anger and fear that was embedded in a very long speech. I mean, it was a very long speech also about so many things with regard to crime and terrorism that are all true in terms of there is crime, there is terrorism, but there wasn't a sort of unifying message about how we the people are also going to contribute to changing this America. It was only about Trump, to some degree, as hearing our voice and being our voice. And so there was a little bit of a disconnect from the voter to Trump and Trump to the voter.
Thanks for the call, Anita. We'll go next to Rich on the line in Burlington. Rich, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just said I am not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I'm an independent. But one thing that I noticed in watching some of the convention, and I'm not thrilled with the candidates, either candidate from either party. But one thing that I found really disturbing, and I'm wondering if it's going to be duplicated with the Democratic convention, was, and I watched it on NPR, the coverage and everything, and I wish someone would time measure the amount of time that the commentators were commenting on what was being said instead of letting the people speak and hearing the speeches. And Glenn Ifill and the group at the table commenting on the everything, it seemed like they were just looking and digging for dirt. And there's plenty of dirt, no question about it, but I'm just hoping other people recognize that, and a lot of other people recognize that. Again, I'm not a fan of Donald Trump, but it's why do we need commentators to tell us what we just heard or what we're going to hear.
Gotcha, Rich. Thanks for the call. So the media mediating too much, he's saying, Lily.
Yeah, and you know, there's always concerns with regard to what the media is paying attention to and what they're focusing in on. And of course, you know, stations like C-SPAN tend to run a lot of the speeches completely devoid of commentary, and so there's less of that. Most of the network television shows or network stations are interested in keeping you interested, so you won't change the channel. And so in making sure that they have people commenting and possibly, you know, focusing on foibles and mistakes or whatever is going to actually keep viewers from changing the channel or turning the television off.
We're looking at this week's Republican convention with Lily Gorin from Carroll University. We'll go back to your calls now. We've got Scott on the line in Appleton. Scott, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Thanks. What do you think?
Well, I'm a Republican. Through and through and stuff. Like to kind of corner myself or put myself as more of a conservative than just a Republican. And I am just disheartened by Donald Trump. You know, early in the campaign system and stuff is they had made the pact together, but then as far as woo back whoever wins and stuff, but then later on, before the campaign, before the primaries were over, he had said that he wasn't going to, and that I don't need anybody's endorsement. They don't have to have mine. You know, I don't need theirs. They don't need mine. The other thing, Ted Cruz is no schmuck. He got thousands, hundreds, millions, whatever. He got tons of votes. He had, 400, 500 delegates?
Mm-hmm. Scott, thanks a lot for the call. Running a little low on time, and I want to bring Lily in on this. Scott is the person that I think a lot of Republicans are worried about right now. Republicans who are not happy with Donald Trump as president, not sure what they're going to do on Election Day.
Yeah, and I think this is, you know, this has been the issue all along in this primary season. And I said it to my students all during the spring, is that the Republican Party going into the primaries and the caucuses in 2016 is not the Republican Party that has necessarily come out of the caucuses and the primaries with Donald Trump as their standard bearer. And I think that the caller, Scott, is, you know, sort of pointing at some of the issues around Trump and to some degree coming out of this convention, which was an attempt, again, to try to unify the party. That was a lot of what Wisconsinite Rince Priebus, as chair of the RNC, was working to do. And a lot of the other speakers were also working to do, as well as Trump in his speech last night. But it's not clear. We'll know in a couple of days, you know, as polls start to roll in with information, whether or not there is a sense of a more unified Republican Party.
Briefly, Lily, as we wrap up, a lot of Wisconsin speakers at the convention this week. There's been talk that Wisconsin may not even be a battleground state this time around. Other people disagree with that. Briefly, your take. Is Wisconsin at play?
I mean, I think Wisconsin is at play. We also have a very high profile and probably very combative Senate race that's also going to be part of why Wisconsin is not necessarily to be written off. But if you remember the primary here in Wisconsin, Donald Trump was not the winner. Ted Cruz was. Ted Cruz did really well in the primary in Wisconsin. And so there may be more Republicans or conservatives like the caller Scott, who is maybe not satisfied with Trump as the Republican standard bearer this year.
Lily, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University. She joined us from our Milwaukee studio to talk about the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. She'll be back with us precisely 1 week from now to recap the Democratic National Convention from Philadelphia. Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday, and we'll bring you flavors from the American South with a lot of interesting twists and turns along the way. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard is out today. Coming up, we'll learn about Madison 365 Academy, an effort to help recruit and train the next generation of journalists here in Wisconsin. First, we're taking a look beyond the Midwest and into the southern part of the states for this week's Food Friday. For anyone that's a fan of comfort food, we'll have everything from classics like mac and cheese to fusion flavors like curried and fried cauliflower. Lazarus Lynch joins us now. He draws on flavors from the American South and around the world. He's a chef, and you can catch him online and on TV, where he calls himself the son of a Southern chef. We've got some recipes posted, including some of his videos, on the Central Time Facebook page. You may know him from his work on Taste Made or the Food Network. Lazarus, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob, for having me. It's great to talk to you.
Well, clearly family is an important part of your cooking heritage. You're the son of a Southern chef, as you say. What did you learn from your parents? What's their background when it comes to food?
Sure. Well, so my father, absolutely, family's incredibly important to me. My father was a chef from Alabama, so he grew up learning how to cook from his mother and his grandmother, who were both phenomenal cooks and housekeepers and beauticians. And so my father was always very connected to soulful cooking, and he learned it in the South, and he moved to New York City when he was a little boy and lived here, worked in his own businesses, and finally opened up a restaurant in his latter part of his career. And my mother is actually from Guyana. Guyana, so north of Brazil, from South America, and she lived there for about 13 years, and when she was 13, then moved to London and stayed there for quite a while. She stayed there probably over a decade and then moved to New York City, met my father. They lived in the same apartment complex and then got married, and they had me and my other brothers and sisters. So family has always been a very, very big part of where food comes from for me. My mother, obviously being from Guyana, I experienced a lot of Guyanese food, and I also experienced foods that were traditional in Europe, you know, such as the pork sausage rolls, and tea was very popular every day. We drank tea. And then obviously my father, who is from the South, mac and cheese, fried chicken, catfish, you name it. It was in our household every single day. It was a part of our culture. It was a part of who we are. So for me, family is an incredibly important part of what I do. And it's an important part of celebrating food. And that's what I do every single day.
I'm just trying to picture what family dinner looked like in your household growing up, because that's a lot of influences there.
Absolutely. It could be, you know, family dinners were interesting. During the week, it was pretty simple. You know, my mom did most of the cooking. My father was an entrepreneur, so he owned retail stores. He owned 99-cent stores, and then finally the restaurant, which was his last business. But my mother was pretty much the matriarch in terms of creating the food for the household during the week. And it was very, very simple things. Spaghetti and meatballs, really Americanized foods. And every now and then she would do something like saltfish or codfish served with rice, or something really, really humble like a corned beef out of a can that she would flavor up and spice up. Because the truth is my parents didn't have a lot of money, and so they had to make every little bit stretch and feed four hungry children. So my mother really made it work. And on the weekends, specifically on Sundays, it was really like Thanksgiving. My father would create everything from his macaroni and cheese to his coleslaw, which was passed down from his grandmother and great-grandmother, collard greens, and the like. And so Sundays were really, I guess, the most important dinner days for us in terms of the quantity of food that was prepared.
When did you know you wanted to go into being a chef and preparing food and inventing food in a lot of ways?
Right. Well, you know, it wasn't until my dad opened the restaurant when I was 10 years old that I started to think of food as a career. My father had always cooked. He cooked with us all the time. I remember when I was probably 7 years old, my mother had gone on a trip and she took my brothers and sisters with her, and I was home with dad. And I remember it being like 12 o'clock at night and my father waking me up saying, "Hey, do you want to go in the kitchen and cook something?" And that memory of creating something at midnight with my dad as a young kid really, I think, stuck with me even until this day. It was always about connecting with my father. And so that's how I viewed food. And when my father opened the restaurant, I saw it as a way for him to make money, and I saw it as a career opportunity. And quite frankly, I just loved the rush of a kitchen. I love the urgency of making large pans of whatever for customers. And so I worked with him in the restaurant. I did everything from stock the shelves to ring the register up, restock sodas, to helping him peel veg. I mean, you know, if he needed the help, I just did it. And I fell in love with it. My siblings and I, we were sort of my father's first employees. And I was the one that stuck with it, and I fell in love with it.
We're talking to Lazarus Lynch, a.k.a. the son of a Southern chef. We've got some of his recipes. We've got recipes and videos linked on the Central Time Facebook page. I want to get into one of those now. Get us a little hungry, Lazarus. Macaroni and cheese. Okay, everybody's had that. You've got macaroni and cheese with Gouda, and that's one of the recipes we've got up there. Why A, it sounds awesome. B, why Gouda?
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. Everyone's had mac and cheese a thousand ways. And I thought, I want to do something a little bit more interesting. Growing up, we've always had mac and cheese very traditionally. My father used about 4 to 6 cheeses, but they were cheeses that you could find in your grocery store. I worked at a cheese shop when I was in Buffalo, New York for college. I went to Buffalo State College. And I worked at this cheese shop, and I learned about every kind of cheese. And Gouda was actually the cheese I fell in love with the most. I thought it was just such a brilliant flavor. It was complex. It had a lot of different flavor profiles that could be paired well with many different things, including sweet foods like pears. So Gouda for me was an idea to let me try to jazz up this standard classic mac and cheese that, as you said, everyone already has had in their life, and do something a little different. Now, what was great about the Gouda that I chose to use was that it actually had a marbling of bacon, which was smoked.
Whoa.
So the Gouda itself was smoked, and there was bacon throughout the whole pound of Gouda. So, I mean, you're talking about comfort food at its highest, right?
Big time. And I'll say, Lazarus, I love Gouda, but I just eat it. You know, maybe on a cracker or with bread or with an apple or something like that. I don't know that I've ever cooked with it. Any secrets to making it, you know, work well, make a good the cheesy sauce in the mac and cheese?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, I do a classic mac and cheese. Well, first of all, I make macaroni and cheese many different ways. Sometimes I will do just a bechamel sauce, which is a classic French sauce, one of the five mother sauces. And so what you can do is melt some butter and add some flour, basically equal parts flour to butter. Get that nice and cooked down. Add some milk. Add the Gouda or the Gruyere or whatever you're using. Grate it up. And it becomes this delicious cheese sauce. And I really find that when you melt the Gouda cheese, it just has this really nice, luscious quality to it. It stays really pure. It's a great melting cheese. It's also, like you said, it's a great cheese to pair with a cracker or an apple or a pear, things that are classic like that. So the way that I prepared it in the video doesn't use the bechamel method. It's actually a method my father used, which was using eggs, so large eggs, and carnation milk out of a can that you whip together, and you add a little bit of melted butter in that, season that up with salt, pepper, and garlic powder, and add the cheese to that, and it melts inside of the oven. So there are tons of different directions you can go with the melting cheese effect, but Gouda is a great, great choice for melting cheese.
And this Gouda mac and cheese, I think a mac and cheese is a side dish a lot of times. What would that go well with?
Well, you know, Gouda mac and cheese, really, you can eat it by itself and be quite happy. But
sure,
if you wanted to pair it with something else, you could totally do a collard green. I love to do a combination of kale greens and Swiss chard and collards or turnip greens. I've got a great turnip greens recipe on my website and channel, social channels. So it goes really well with those kinds of things. And also, people love to eat it with a piece of chicken, piece of roasted chicken, or a piece of fried chicken, or a piece of barbecue chicken, or barbecue ribs. So macaroni and cheese is one of those delicious, comforting foods that you'd be happy to eat it by itself, or happy to eat it next to a salad to make you feel a little bit more balanced about it, or go right all in and just go comfort all the way with some fried chicken.
Now, we're in Wisconsin, of course. We're familiar with our cheese here. Let's go to one we're not as familiar with. We're not in grits territory in Wisconsin. And another link we have up on the Central Time Facebook page is to your shrimp and grits recipe. First of all, for a Wisconsinite who hasn't encountered a lot of grits in my life, give me grits 101. What is it? How do you cook it?
Sure. So, you know, grits is a very interesting thing. I was actually having a conversation with a fellow Southern cook about the difference between grits and polenta, for example. So I grew up on a white classic grit, and grits are cornmeal that you know, that are grind down, and it's traditionally a little bit finer it's less fine than your traditional polenta or yellow cornmeal. So it's got a little bit of a grit taste. And so a delicious way to cook it for me growing up is we did milk or water, a combination of both, or stock. And you add a little bit of grits. Once you bring that to a boil, you add a little bit of the grit, a little bit at a time, until it gets nice and thick, and then you finish it with butter, salt, and pepper. So as a kid, I always loved a sweet grit. I just didn't like the savory grit. So the way I like to think about grits is the thing you eat for breakfast. Polenta is the thing you eat for dinner. And, you know, polenta is a great substitute for grits. I, in fact, make it all the time, but I don't think sometimes people equate a yellow cornmeal to a white cornmeal as a grit. So I like to think of them as one and the same, but have different flavor variations. But that's a very standard way of making a grit. I love adding a little bit of heavy cream in there to give it a little bit more body and give it a little bit more luster, if you will. But those are grits. And it's really, really delicious with shrimp, as you know, is a very classic Southern dish, shrimp and grits, or salmon croquettes, which my father prepared all the time with some grits on the side with a little bit of butter on top. So it really goes well with seafood. And I think the Southerners really love to put grits with their seafood.
I'm talking to Chef Lazarus Lynch right now about some traditional and contemporary Southern-inspired cooking, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you from the South, or is your family? What are some of your favorite food traditions from there, maybe ones that you're trying to help pass on here in the Midwest? Call in with your favorite recipes. How do you like to cook, serve, and eat mac and cheese or grits? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got a lot of links to recipes that Lazarus has up, some recipes, some videos along the way, too. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation on Southern-style cooking with a twist. We've got Lazarus Lynch with us, and we want you to join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us about your favorites from the South. Is there a food that you miss if you're from there, that you enjoy if you've traveled down there? How do you incorporate those flavors into your cooking here in the Midwest? Maybe you have your own way of putting an international spin on your favorite comfort food. We just heard about that Gouda macaroni and cheese. Do you have your own way to jazz up the traditions like mac and cheese? Are you a fan of grits? Do you have questions about how to cook Southern-style food for Lazarus? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post and find some recipes on the Central Time Facebook page. So, Lazarus, you are adapting some of your dad's recipes, among other things, from the South, and you're looking often at international influences. What kind of things do you like to try to mix in with the traditional Southern cooking?
Yes, and, you know, international food to me is brilliant, and it's like learning about your friends next door, because really I think food brings the world together, and I love every time I have the opportunity to experience a different culture. So I lived in China, in Beijing, for 3 months in 2011. I was there doing a study abroad internship, and I fell in love with Asian cuisine and Asian flavors. So I oftentimes find myself picking up a bottle of sriracha, or I'll find myself in the grocery store buying some kimchi just to have on hand. And so I decided, you know what, I'm doing a lot of the Southern food. Why don't I try to pair these two cuisines together? Very different, very unusual, but let me see how this goes. So I decided I was going to use a classic rib. My father made ribs a lot. So I was going to take a rib, pair it with some honey and miso. And what I got out of that was a miso honey rib, which is just delicious. And that's on my YouTube channel. You can watch the video. But that is a really, really delicious way of bridging flavors together. Another thing is jerk chicken. Many family members of mine are from Jamaica, and jerk chicken is really popular in Jamaica and other parts of the Caribbean. So what I decided to do was to pair that jerk chicken flavor with ramen noodles. I worked at a Japanese restaurant making ramen. That was my only job to do every day, was to make those noodles. And so I decided, why don't I pair those flavors together? So I think it's a unusual, unexpected way of approaching food, but it definitely does speak to my heart when I think about the food I love to eat, the food that brings me back to a place I've lived in, or a place I traveled, or the people that I love. So really, there are many different ways that I do that every single day, but I love to surprise people with those international fusion flavors.
That sounds great. Let's go to one of our callers now at 800-642-1234. Colin is on the line in Dubuque, Iowa. Colin, hi.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Colin, or ask us about?
Well, two quick questions. First of all, I was just going to ask for a general recipe. I know you just mentioned salmon croquettes. Well, I was wondering how much different that is from, like, your traditional fish cake, like a salmon cake or crab cake, and maybe just kind of a general recipe. Then the other question was, I wanted to ask if he has ever put ketchup on his mac and cheese.
Ketchup on mac and cheese. Let's start there and then move on to our salmon croquettes, Lazarus.
Yeah, let's start with the ketchup on the mac and cheese. Thanks, Colin, for your questions. So I don't put ketchup on my mac and cheese, but my family puts hot sauce on their mac and cheese.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
You know, it's a very classic thing to do. It's like the Beyonce song, "Have Hot Sauce in My Bag." I mean, my brother literally carries hot sauce with him in his bag, in his book bag. It's just a thing that we do. So, but my family in Europe loves to put ketchup on literally everything and anything. So I think to each their own. I personally just have it straight up, you know, mac and cheese, nothing else. For croquettes, though, really good question. So a salmon croquette and, you know, crab cake or salmon cake, very, very similar. Both use a binder, which is egg. So it helps it to stay together and form into the shape of, you know, the patty. But with a croquette, you know, you're frying it on both sides, just as you would with a salmon cake or a crab cake. But the texture of the meat is a little bit different. So, you know, with a croquette, it's usually a little bit flatter. You're usually pan frying it on both sides. And you're usually using some kind of cornmeal or some sort of flour. With a salmon cake, it's a little bit thicker. It's literally, you know, more cake sized compared to a croquette, which is generally a little bit flatter. My father used to hand shape his salmon croquettes in his hand, and my father had pretty large hands, so it was probably about a 6-inch diameter salmon croquette. But a really easy recipe, if I can just give it to you in 30 seconds,
sure,
is you take salmon in a can, remove all the bones, you add bell peppers, red bell pepper, green bell peppers, chop them up very finely, a little bit of onion grated, and then you're going to also add some garlic powder, some salt, and some pepper. You can use 2 eggs to bind it together, and then just create them into patties, and then you want to form them into the rounds, and then dredge them in some self-rising flour, a combination of self-rising flour and cornmeal, yellow cornmeal, and then just pan fry it in some canola oil for about, you know, 4 minutes on each side, just until both sides are golden brown and crisp. And it's a very, very easy and delicious salmon croquette.
Hope that helps, Colin. We're talking to Lazarus Lynch, a.k.a. the son of a Southern chef. A lot of recipes on the Central Time Facebook page. Back to our callers with Pat in Green Bay. Pat, hi.
Hi. Yes, here's a question on making fish. I drove in Tennessee one time, and at a small grill in the country, I had the best fried fish I've ever had. I asked the cook how she makes it, and I think she just said flour, ordinary things, but she said it turns out best on a dry day. It depends on how much humidity there is. So my questions are, do you agree with that, and what is your favorite preparation? Is flour and cornmeal the best, or do you have a lighter breading?
Pat, thanks. Fried fish, big issue here in Wisconsin, Lazarus. Go for it.
Okay. Here's your 911 fried chicken. You know, my father made fried chicken every single day at his restaurant.
Ooh, fried fish she's going for. I'm sorry.
Fried fish. My father made fried fish every single day at his restaurant. He served it with his tartar sauce and on 2 pieces of bread, and people loved it. And, you know, I agree that the humidity can affect the way that the fish is cooked. But what I would do is I like to pat it dry. Once I wash the fish, I pat it completely dry, and I use a combination of self-rising flour. It's really important that you use self-rising flour because it has baking powder inside of it, so it helps it to be a little bit crisper on the outside. And I season that with some Old Bay seasoning, or you can use some paprika, some garlic powder, salt, pepper, some rosemary, oregano, and some thyme. And I use that. I dredge the fish on both sides. And my father used to fry it in soybean oil. And if you don't have soybean oil, you can use a vegetable oil. You can use a corn oil. You just want an oil that has a higher smoking point, such as a soybean or a peanut oil, for example, which has a higher smoking point. So that just means that it can stay hotter at a consistent temperature for a longer period of time. So you can cook a lot of fried fish back to back. And that is, you know, and then once it comes out, you drain it and put a little bit of salt on the top, and it's delicious.
Thanks for the call, Pat. Time for one more quick call from John in Caledonia, Minnesota. John, hi.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Great.
I had to pull over. I just had their comments. I'm a certified executive chef living in Minnesota, but I've had the pleasure of living in Fort Worth, Texas, and Richmond, Virginia. So south and south, they don't combine. But the people up here just don't know the great flavor of the ground sassafras, the gumbo file, as they call it up here. I mean, I've made some incredible soups and some different gumbos and all kinds of great southern New Orleans dishes that just people just don't have it up here. They just don't get it.
John, thanks a lot. And Lazarus, briefly as we wrap up, you're trying to help us spread the love there in New York and now here to us in Wisconsin.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think Southern cuisine is one of those cuisines that brings people together. It's all about family. It's all about comfort food. It's all about communal styles of eating. And, you know, that's what I'm trying to do here in New York City amongst my generation, millennials, and also try to spread that everywhere that I can. So it's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, Rob. And thanks for sharing time.
And real quick, Lazarus, maybe your next experiment, what are you going to try combining next?
You know, I've been thinking about combining, doing something with sushi, because I love sushi, and perhaps pairing that with something Southern. Haven't quite figured it out yet, but that's to come.
I think deep fried okra in a sushi roll sounds really good to me.
Oh, that's, there you go.
Boom.
That's it.
All right, Lazarus, boom. Thank you. Lazarus, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much.
That was the son of a Southern chef, Lazarus Lynch, sharing some classic and contemporary Southern recipes with us. You can see some of his recipes, actually a bunch of them, on the Central Time Facebook page or at WPR.org. Let me run through. We didn't get to curry cauliflower fritters with cilantro yogurt sauce. We've got a link to his, I think, a video on that one. He's got a fried fish sandwich. He talked a little bit about that. And some Dr. Pepper sesame ribs. So if you're wondering what you're going to cook this weekend, look no further. Find some links at WPR.org or on the Central Time Facebook page. While you're on the Facebook page, if you have a love of Southern cuisine, think it's underappreciated up here in the Midwest, we'd sure like you to tell us about that too. Again, that's on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. The big Republican convention just wrapped up in Cleveland. The Democrats, they're getting ready for their big week in Philadelphia. That set me to thinking, has Wisconsin ever hosted a major party's nominating convention? I set out on minutes of casual online research, and the answer, never. Never has a major political party hosted its convention in Wisconsin. Chicago? Sure. Twin Cities? Yep. Not Wisconsin. Now, I said major party. Third parties have shown us some love over the years. The Socialist Party of America met in Milwaukee in 1932. That was when the city had a socialist mayor. And the Socialist Party came back to hold five conventions in Milwaukee, apparently from 1976 to 2000. The Green Party held their big event in Milwaukee in 2004. The big question, would we want a major party convention here in the state? It brings, yeah, a lot of money and attention, but it brings a whole lot of hullabaloo, too. And maybe we don't want that here in Wisconsin. I don't know. So I want to know from you, would you want the Democrats or the Republicans in Wisconsin to hold their convention here in 2020? Why not both? Tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us a message on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.